This program is brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks. You'll find over 100,000 titles in just about every genre. And if you want to listen to Alex Olean's Inside and help keep this wonderful show going, sign up at www.audiblepodcast.com/bat for a free audiobook, a 30-day trial, perhaps a hug in the future. Because sometimes you need more in life than two eggs and some fancy skillet moves to make a decent omelet.
Okay, so I am here with Alex Olean, who is most recently the author of not one but two books, Signs and Wonders, a short story collection, and Inside, a novel. Alex, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Thanks for being here. Now, I may be misconstrued as the nine types of weather guy in E.M. Forster's aspects of the novel, but as a native Californian, I do feel compelled to ask you this question. There are two moments in these two books where you do remark on the California weather. One is the beginning of the story, The Only Child, where Sophie calls California weather sunny and childlike. And Inside, you have this situation where Anne is in Los Angeles, she's running along the beach, and she's calling this sort of fantastical dream. Now, I don't know why this actually stuck inside my head, but I feel this is a very good jumping off point to describe what it is you do in terms of selecting those ripe details, because, you know, I can see it from a California point of view because it is too good to be true. I can also see it as someone who has lived here in New York for 5 to 6 years and also say, well, yes, it is too good to be true and it deserves to be mocked or ridiculed in some sense. But at the same time, we're also dealing with an author who is describing this through a character. And this becomes something that I obsess with, and I'm sure some other reader is going to obsess over something along those lines. I ask you this because about how you choose these details, such as the weather, because, you know, your prose is very sparse, very economic, very selective in its own criteria in terms of its syntax. So, you know, how does something like the California weather or, for example, Chinese food, and also featuring in both books, how do these things make their ways into stories? What is the filtering mechanism that causes this? A very bad, eccentric, possibly deranged way to start this, but I thought I would do that.
No, I think it's always great to start with weather. I certainly think that everything in the books is filtered through the consciousness of the characters, and that's always where I begin. It's my entry point as a writer to start creating a narrative, and it's certainly how I choose the details, which is not really a conscious process. It's more that I'm there in the moment with the character and imagining what might be the most conspicuous thing to them. So both of those descriptions of California, to respond to that, are absolutely moments of experience that are specific to characters who are from the East Coast and wintry climates who come out, and of course that's what they remark upon. Of course it feels like a fantasy and an escape and something amazing and remarkable, because to them it is.
Did you get burned in California? Did you get burned by the weather, or burned metaphorically?
I love the weather in California, and I do think it's amazing, but for me, I will always experience it as not home, right? Not the climate of home, and I will always be the person remarking on the sunshine in January.
Okay. Well, aside from Anne struggling in New York in Signs and Wonders, you have a number of stories set in New York City, and Who Do You Love? Made an impression upon me for a number of reasons. The notion of a band called Das Boot, which is actually noted around a German mode or a mood as opposed to the actual Teutonic experience full bore. That resonated with me because, you know, I've known people like rather interestingly, she doesn't have a name. The woman who is smitten with Adam, this aging rock star who's past his prime, doesn't want to do any particular work, and yet he has a draw in Williamsburg. That men like that are allowed to get away with such pathetic behavior, both in that and also with what we see in Inside and what we see in a number of the other stories in Signs and Wonders. I'm curious, do you think that this particular fixation is common largely to New York, the vocational experience? Is it rooted in your own personal experience? You know, how do these fixations on, I suppose, vocational nightmares along these lines and the terrible influence on other people? How do these come about?
Wait, so by vocational experiences, do you mean the fact that he wants to be a yes. rock star and has an entire...
Aspirations. Is this common to New York? Why does this seem to be your idea of what New York is?
Well, it's not my only idea of what New York is, but I do think that both New York and Los Angeles are places where a lot of young people move in their 20s to pursue artistic dreams that they thought were less available to them, you know, wherever they came from. So in that story, it's definitely, it's the kind of story about someone who is on the cusp of being too old to be aspiring, right? At a certain point, you're just sort of a person who never made it, and that's an extremely difficult moment to switch over in your own head. And then I have, I think, written about other characters in Inside, like Anne, who is an aspiring actress who starts out, first of all, in the theater world in New York and then goes out to L.A. to try to, or winds up being cast in a TV show in L.A. I just think that there's something about both those cities that are, they are conduits to not just any kind of vocational experience, but artistic experiences, and then they don't work out for people, and that's incredibly difficult, and it's part of your growing up to try to figure out how to come to terms with that.
Did New York work out for you? I mean, I know you worked in the publishing industry, and, you know, this leads me to ask you also if you had to get certain elements of how you viewed fiction and how you viewed books outside of your system in order to truly inhabit these stories as an artist.
Well, you know, it's a really interesting question. I moved to New York straight out of college, and I did work in publishing, and I loved it. I learned a lot, and I was having a great time, but I also had this, you know, secretly harbored desire to write, and I would go to work all day, and there were two things about it that were difficult. One was that a huge part of my job as an editorial assistant was to reject manuscripts. So I was right there at the forefront of rejection and understanding how difficult the odds were.
Did you reject anybody big? Or?
I don't really want to say who I rejected, but a big part of what I rejected were slush pile people. You know, the people who are just, you know, writing in cold without an agent. And but there were so many of them. I mean, my entire cubicle would be full of these works of love. You know, 500 page novels that people were sending in that I, you know, would write a, you know, simple 2-sentence letter rejecting. So that was hard when you think about, well, what's going to become of my work? But then on the other side of the coin was that. The books that were accepted, I mean, I was working at Knopf, and we were publishing people like Cormac McCarthy and Tobias Wolff and Toni Morrison, and their work was so incredibly sophisticated and adept. And then I would go home and I would write these terrible, terrible, terrible stories. And the contrast between what I could do and what these published authors could do on the one hand, and then the rejection of the unsolicited manuscripts on the other hand, really did not create an ideal context for artistic risk-taking. So I think it was really because of that, and not something about New York in particular. I love New York, but it was really about, you know, working in this atmosphere of rejection and impossible standards that I just thought, wow, I really can't do this. And, you know, I made the sort of impetuous decision that you make when you're in your early 20s and you're like, I'm leaving New York and I'm starting over, you know, and it's going to be an adventure. I think, you know, had I been a little older, I probably would have realized that there are ways that you can reconcile those two things. But at the time, it seemed like going away and writing in secret far away from New York publishing was the thing that I had to do.
Well, how did you retain your love for reading and writing when you have to be basically team Knopf, and pretty much everybody who works at a publishing house can only read the books in that publishing house? There's no time to read other books, maybe, you know, downtime, maybe summer hours and some so forth, but pretty much you're reading constantly and you're reading that house. Do you think that there is anything irreparable from that particular experience, or have you largely dealt with that by now?
Yes, I'm in recovery from it many years later. No, it was actually a great experience for me because I had been an English major in college, but I had really had a very traditional education where I was extremely familiar with canonical English and American literature through 1950, I would say, and I had read very little contemporary fiction before I started working at Knopf, and there, I mean, even just at Knopf, there was an incredible diversity of people being published, so it was actually a really exciting time for me to discover all of these, the entire contemporary fiction scene, which I had had no idea what it was about. So that was really a joyous experience to read all that stuff. And then when I quit, I then just broadened that and tried to read, you know, as widely as I could in both directions. I mean, not just to read other houses' contemporary fictions, but then to go back and to read even more older stuff, which I do think is really important for writers and something that's a little underestimated today.
When you were writing these stories secretly, I mean, you know, well, what was this like? I mean, did you write anything during that time that actually was published, or was it all pretty much junk? And what advantages were there in fiction writing outside of New York when you went on this journey after the Hill and you turned your back to the publishing industry and said, no, I shall go forth and be a fiction writer and a teacher and all that?
Right. Well, when I left New York, I moved to Albuquerque, New Mexico, which is, you know, sort of as far away from New York as you could get. And I would, I worked in a bookstore, and then when I got off my shift, I would go to a cafe, and I would, because I was young and could do this, I would order 2 double lattes, and I would drink this enormous amount of caffeine in the evening, and I would sit there and I would write longhand these terrible stories in the coffee shop. And I did that for 3 or 4 years, and they were absolutely terrible. And no, they have never seen the light of day, and I hope they never will. I mean, they were just awful. It was an apprenticeship. You know, I was teaching myself how to write, and I had originally thought that I could do that in a year. And of course, I didn't, you know, improve in a year. By the end of the 4th year, I had written some stories that were not completely terrible. And did I publish them? No, but I used them to apply to graduate school, where I spent 3 more years of apprenticeship, you know, right? I mean, it just takes a really, really long time, and that was something that, had I realized that when I left New York, I don't know that I would have done it, but I was stupid enough to think that it would be a quick process, and that gave me some of the bravery that that I needed to take that risk.
What do you think was the ultimate trigger point for you, that moment where you finally said, you know, I'm not writing complete shit, I'm actually writing something that is meaningful? What was that particular element? Was it just really coming to grips with human behavior? Was it coming to grips with character? Was it language? What was it, do you think?
I do remember pretty clearly the first story that I ever wrote that I thought was halfway decent, and I did wind up publishing it in a literary magazine. It was a first-person story. It's actually the first story in my first collection, Babylon. And I would say the thing that distinguished it was not really language. Like, I had always been reasonably good at stringing together some words in a way that sounded musical or that had a certain cadence to it. But I had no real voice. And in that first story, which is called The King of Kohlrabi, I, for the first time, felt like I had nailed this teenage, you know, wise-ass, slightly absurdist voice that had a particular point of view on the world that didn't sound to me generic, that had some humor in it, that combined comedy and sadness in a way that I thought worked well for me. So that was the first moment where I was like, okay, not just could I be competent, but maybe I could write something that sounds particular to me, which was the most important thing.
Why do you think it took you so long to find a voice? Did you just want to hide, or did you get so used to hiding in, you know, among the publishing people, or even in a cafe in New Mexico?
I think it's more a personality thing for me, and I'm a pretty reserved person, and I think I was withholding too much from the page as well. I had written a lot of third-person stories where there was too much distance from the characters, and writing is an act of exposure in a way that I didn't necessarily anticipate. So that story that I was talking about before, the first-person story, it had a lot of me in it. It was based on personal experience. There was a certain vulnerability to that, and I think then I also wouldn't necessarily have written it if I had ever thought that it would be published, but I was still in that cave, in that feeling of privacy, and I was like, okay, I'll do this. And then, you know, eventually it was published, and my family and friends read it, and that was strange, but, you know, it was exciting too.
Well, this leads me to also ask you, because one thing that strikes me about these two books, a lot of terrible things happen. You know, probably the most callous thing a character probably does is in Inside, where you have Anne treat that woman who just loves her so callously. I just was like blown away by that. But despite the fact that bad things happen, the characters don't really seek revenge in the stories and in Inside. And I found that to be extremely interesting. And I wanted to ask you about this in light of what you were talking here about being reserved. Do you think that revenge is something you don't personally feel? Do you think that it's a cheap resolution point when you're writing a story? Why don't these characters really want to go ahead and get their just desserts? Because I was surprised. I mean, you know, they're all nice and everything. They do cruel behavior sometimes, and they are the victims of cruel behavior, but they don't want revenge. So what is up with this?
That's funny. You've given me a great idea for future books, because people often complain that the narratives that I write are too unresolved. So I'm pretty sure next book there'll be like a big Mexican standoff gunfight at the end that will speak to questions such as yours. Well, I think that it's possible that... some of this it comes from my reserved personality, but I think it more has to do with my feelings about human nature, that a lot of times the equation is not direct in the way that we live our lives emotionally. The consequences of the things that happen to us, including the ways that we are hurt, tend to emerge later on, right? You may have had the experience of being in a relationship with someone and they're treating you poorly and you can't understand why, and it probably has something to do with something that happened to them in the past with their parents or the way that they grew up or previous experiences that they had. So the idea that they would be getting revenge, I think it's just not true to life. They're not getting revenge on their parents for raising them a certain way, but it is going to come out in some subsequent relationship, and it's very sort of subtle and idiosyncratic the way that these consequences are felt in our lives.
Revenge not true to life? Really?
Sorry to disappoint you.
I mean, you know, that means you must be a nice person or something, but, you know, you've never felt a streak of revenge or envy or even, you know, a kind of begrudging admiration for someone?
Oh, I've certainly felt all those things, but I'm just saying that I think that the paths by which our emotions are made manifest aren't necessarily in neat packages where you're expressing anger at one person, but really it's, you know, arising from anger at a previous person.
What is the notion of therapy and inside? I mean, you know, you have this therapist, she's trying to help this girl, and I'm going to do my best not to spoil it, but, you know, her efforts to help her are completely contained within that room until, of course, the parents enter the equation. And this leads to on one hand, the book is actually doing a lot in relation to this question of empathy, both in terms of what's the ultimate result of letting someone into your home? Can they screw you over? Can they take advantage of you? Is there a certain blindness that comes to empathy? There's that on one hand, but on the other hand, there's this idea that if you go to something professional like therapy, it's not necessarily going to insulate you from, say, you know, the rather mean actions of other people who are putting you into therapy and so forth. So, you know, I'm curious, you know, what, maybe just to find a question out of all these observations, you know, what was it that struck you about empathy first when approaching Inside? And maybe this might also be a good jumping off point to ask you if, you know, any one character started off perhaps as a story and whether you married one story to another and how this came about.
Yeah, sure. The story really began with the therapist character, whose name is Grace, and the book for me began in the writing process where it begins now, which is the opening scene where she's skiing in this park in Mount Royal, and she comes across a man who has just tried unsuccessfully to commit suicide. He's tried to hang himself in the woods, and she, not only does she rescue him from that immediate situation, but she then sort of takes it upon herself to rescue him or attempt to rescue him, you know, beyond that in the days and weeks to come. And that scene that I had in my mind was the one that I kept returning to, but I decided that it really wasn't going, their relationship wasn't enough for me to build the whole book around. And I was interested in all these ideas about helping and about empathy, and I decided it would be really interesting to use her, the therapist, as the fulcrum of the book, but then examine her at different moments in her life, in different relationships in her life. So not only is she sort of in her personal relationship with this guy, but she's also in a therapeutic relationship with her client, this troubled teenage girl, and then she also has later on a relationship with her ex-husband. So to me, that was a way of sort of building dimensionality for that theme of empathy. I'm not sure I really set out to write a book about empathy, but I was interested in the idea of a helper character, of someone who is driven to help people. And the question for me that I was trying to answer as I was writing is, what does drive someone to do that? What are the personalities types that are driven to interfere in other people's lives, and what are the what are the benefits of that, but also what are some of the costs of that? Why is it important to help people, even though so often we fail? And that's probably why there's a lot of darkness in the book, because there are some failures of helping. There are limitations to what we can do for other people for a lot of reasons.
But these characters don't put limitations on the way they help people. They allow themselves to be taken in by people who are kind of operating them. I mean, you know, hey, by the way, there's this guy and so forth. So, you know, this leads me to ask you, I mean, you know, I'm not sure if it's really about limitations. It's about if you go ahead and you want to be a pure empathic person, this is what's, yeah, I mean, it's almost that is their identity to a large degree. I'm curious why, you know, removing that level of cautiousness appealed to you in many of these characters.
Well, sometimes it's just a way of pushing the events of the book forward, but there's a line in the book where Grace, the therapist, says that helping this other person would be a way of feeling her own weight in the world, and that to me struck me as a true idea, that a lot of times when people reach out to help other people, it's not just about the other person, it's also about the helper, right? Yes. And what they need to feel valued, or to feel that they have worth, or that the world is worth living in. And so it's not just a kind of abstract ideology. It is, as you say, an identity and a really sort of emotional need that they might have. So the idea that they would keep pushing forward and, you know, not have personal boundaries, that struck me as a really interesting thing to explore in different relationships.
Lots of divorces and fragmented marriages in these two books, and it leads me to ask, not, you know, have you been through a bad relationship, but why is this such a compelling, fragmented nature with which to begin a story?
Do you think there are a lot of happy marriages in fiction? I mean, I just think that's where the stories are, is in moments of rupture or trouble or difficulty. I mean, I would submit that there are also moments of happiness and places where people come together. But to me, that's, you know, when the status quo is disrupted, when things go wrong, that's when the story starts almost always. And it's always a good place to find people who are destabilized and questioning themselves. And so it's a good moment to explore. It's not a personal, you know, love of mine. I'm not pro-divorce and want to get it out there on the page. It's just sort of...
It's now out here. You're officially pro, not pro-divorce.
All right. That's my platform. Yeah, yeah. I want everyone to know.
Officially not, as opposed to anti.
Right.
Well, actually, this leads me to ask you, because I listened to a radio interview by Don Swain that you did. I didn't realize that he had come out of brief retirement to talk with you. And I learned, actually, you attended his little thing as well. And I listened to that, and you said, well, you know, you went to Harvard, and you actually wanted to be a well-rounded person. And instead, you actually, you really boned up on film and art history and all that, but you had a certain struggle with science. And I'm wondering, you know, just to ask you in how you approach many of these stories, and, you know, especially because Martine has a son who, you know, is very science-oriented, and actually she wants her son to be well-rounded. You know, I'm curious, you know, how you... can use fiction, you know, how are you using it to become more well-rounded, to make up for certain things that you're not necessarily the best at? Is there anything like that going on in terms of, you know, write what you know versus write what you don't know, or anything like that in terms of science, or does it really come from human behavior first?
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. I'm an extremely lopsided person when it comes to that. I mean, everything that I understand of the world is pretty much on the humanities side. And I have tried at various times to educate myself in the sciences and hard and natural, and it has usually been a dismal failure. I will say that I have in my fiction, as a way to try to sort of make the books broader and to deepen the ideas that I'm playing with, I have certainly done some research into science-y type stuff. My first novel is about a group of ragtag environmentalists in New Mexico, and I spent a lot of time reading about ecology and also the politics of the environmental movement. So that to me was a very interesting thing. But of course, I read a ton of books, and then what actually comes, you know, appears on the page is like a tiny sliver of knowledge. The same is true of therapy, actually. I read a lot about, you know, therapy and sort of therapeutic memoirs and handbooks for therapists that describe certain pitfalls that they could fall into, and that was really interesting. I mean, it's a way of expanding your own universe. But I will say that originally, when I was an aspiring writer in my 20s, my hero was Don DeLillo, and one of the things that I really admired about him was the way that he worked with information. And he has a great book about physics and a great book about football, and of course a lot of other topics as well. And I thought that I could be, you know, that kind of writer. And I think eventually you just grow into the writer that you actually are, not the writer that someone else is. And so the idea of writing some really information-laden tome, I just don't think I'm ever going to do that because it doesn't speak to my particular skill set.
Would you say that you cleaved to information during these early years of finding your voice, that this was almost getting in the way of you expressing yourself on the page like this?
Yeah, I remember when I was a teenager, the very first novel I ever tried to write was, it was a satire set in the future involving a water rights battle and a love story between the Prime Minister of Canada and the President of the United States, which I still have somewhere. Needless to say, that did not come off. And, you know, sometimes your reach just exceeds your grasp. What are you going to do?
Well, there's those photos with Cretan and the other leaders, and he was very close. It looked like they were going to kiss. I wonder if that was an inspiration.
Maybe it was. I'm not sure.
So with Vigo Park, the story in Signs and Wonders, you specifically call attention to Chekhov's gut. And you also rather brazenly name a story A Month of Sundays, which is a well-known Updike novel about a sort of reverend who is philandering and so forth. And it leads me to ask you, you know, in light of what you're talking here about information, you know, calling forth explicit references like that. I mean, you know, first of all, one, were you aware of the Updike novel when you wrote that story? And two, you know, being explicit about, you know, who you're responding to. I mean, do you think that that's healthy in fiction? Why do you think that that was necessary, especially in Vigo Park, to call attention, hey, it's Chekhov's gun?
Well, I think that all literature is made of other literature, and there's no reason to pretend that it's not. In Vigo Park, I was really interested in doing a formal experiment where I spoke directly to the reader and spoke about the expectations that you might have of a gun, of a particular set of violent events. And that was really the fun of the story for me. So it was a breaking of the fourth wall the way that they do in theater, and it was something that I hadn't done in previous stories. So to me, it felt really transgressive and exciting, and also funny, you know, funny to just, let's just, you know, be honest and admit that you're reading a book and I'm writing a story and I'm going to speak to you directly about that experience, and why not? So that it was felt very liberating for me. In terms of Month of Sundays, I mean, I did not consciously name that story after the Updike novel, and I think, you know, it's also just an expression, you know, Month of Sundays, so I can't really speak to that as a specific allusion, but I certainly think that I have read a lot of books in my life, and some of that reading is going to come through on the page, and, you know, people are going to see influences and maybe even particular, I don't know, phrases or influences in a lot of places, and I think that's great. I don't have any problem sort of copping to that, and I think that that's what writing should be. It shouldn't exist in a vacuum. It should harken back to everything that came before.
Do you think that sometimes we're too precious with tropes and phrases and titles and names and so forth, that it's all fair game, that there is no expiration date? What are your thoughts on this?
I suppose you could be too precious. I think it's too precious if that's the only... If it's sort of a cardboard cutout that's instead of a story, you know, if that's the only purpose of the story, as long as things go beneath the surface of that and you bring your own take to it, then to me it seems like the trope is just there to provide a little guidance in the way that a title provides guidance to the rest of the story. It's not dictating the entirety of what the story is going to be.
I can't let you get away without doing an extremely wonkish question about your sentences. Your prose style, as I was sort of suggesting, it's very straightforward, very economical. There's this tactile element in relation to where the character is situated, and I'll give you two examples. The first sentence of the stepmother's story. On the plane, in that dizzy, fitful sleep that feels like slipping underwater. Or an inside, you have the sentence, May came to the city. Okay, we're totally fine. The bloom of trees, a wistful pink against a pale sky. So, you know, for you, would you say that knowing your characters comes from knowing your place? How does the sentence kind of steer you further in that direction? Does the dizzy, fitful sleep or the bloom of trees, is this your idea of sort of a comparative contrast? How does this work for you?
I guess I think that nothing happens nowhere, and if you want the reader to be there in the moment with you, then it helps to give them a particular set of sensory guideposts. I think it's one way that readers react viscerally to the moment in fiction. So you could say she was sitting on the plane and then move on to the next moment in the scene, but it feels generic rather than specific to me. So, and as we were talking earlier, of course, her particular reactions to what's going on the plane are going to teach you something about the person that you're dealing with here, too. So it always gets back to character for me.
I wanted to also ask you, I mean, sort of related to this, in Inside, you have Tag's backstory in Uganda, which came as a sort of surprise to me because, I'm going to confess something to you. I was kind of getting a little sick of Tug whining and everything. And then all of a sudden, you have this backstory, and I'm like, oh, whoa, okay, I can relate to him more. You've now messing with the reader's empathy, my empathy here. This is interesting because that whole moment doesn't feel quite like a flashback, and yet much of Inside involves these constant shifts through time and space and so forth. So, you know, I'm wondering, you know, what do you do to, do you need to kind of, in order to sort of see a character from another vantage point, is it necessary for you to often just reconfigure time and place? Is this your way of also discovering more about the character? Do you do this sometimes when a character is kind of flagging a little bit? Do you write these things out of order in some sense and try to rearrange them? How does this work?
Okay, well, that's a big question. There's a lot going on there. Well, so first of all, the Rwanda section of the book, thematically, it really came out of me wanting to expand the idea of helping and empathy onto a bigger canvas. So I have all these characters, these Canadian and American characters with their complicated love lives and parent-child relationships. But for me, the idea of introducing this former aid worker who is troubled by his experiences living through or witnessing part of the genocide in Rwanda was for me a way of saying, well, this question of help and empathy is something that needs to be addressed on an international level as well, between the relationship between, you know, developed nations and nations that need our help. So it was a way of, you know, not to sound pompous, but it was a way for me of trying to give a sort of larger sociopolitical dimension to the themes in the book. In terms of the structure that you're talking about, some of that for me had to do with reading novels that I thought were really exciting, that played around with time, that were fractured in their chronology, or that broke what I perceived as rules that existed for novels. So things like, you know, David Mitchell's Cloud Atlas, or going further back, you know, The House in Paris by Elizabeth Bowen was a book that I really loved, or To the Lighthouse by Virginia Woolf. I love that moment of energy that you get when you pick the reader up and you put them back down and time has passed, you're in a new place. Maybe you're seeing the same character from a different vantage point, or maybe you're seeing a new character and you as the reader have to put the seams together, you have to do some stitching and figure out how these sort of disparate elements of the novel can cohere in a puzzle into your mind. For me, it's a way of enlisting the reader as an active presence, because they have to say, okay, what does Rwanda have to do with the section in LA, or the section in Northern Canada, or the section in Montreal? Makes them do a little work and then solve a little bit of the emotional mystery of the book for themselves.
Sure. But is there any, what kind of false starts do you have when you're, you know, going ahead and doing this sort of cookie cutter formula? I mean, are there situations where, for example, for Inside, did you feel that you wrote sections where you were articulating too much to the reader, that you were spelling things out too much? How did you work out that balance and the balance with what ended up in this book?
Yeah, I had probably more false starts than I could name writing this book, and especially the first section I wrote over and over again trying to figure out what was the story. And, you know, originally, it sounds hilarious to think of it, but originally my idea of the book was completely different, and I had all these absurd plot lines between...
Which is what?
Well, so one writer whose work I really enjoy is William Boyd, the British author, and I had originally thought of writing a densely plotted, action-y William Boyd type book. So there was like an almost sort of a noirish element with like some, you know, corrupt Greek characters in Montreal, and it just like it defeated me completely. And I realized that I wasn't the writer for it, and it wasn't the plot for me. So I definitely had a number of problems with that. But I would say once I hit on the idea that Grace and Tug's story was only part of the book and there were going to be two other main plot lines, and then I was going to make them work together either in... Originally I thought of it as a triptych, and then I changed my mind and decided to think of it as a braid. Once I had that, then everything sort of fell into place for me.
Are there ever any situations when you're working on a story and you have to stop them from becoming a massive novel or some sort of, you know, do you have to stop yourself in any capacity, or do you pretty much arrive at the end and know what the end is? How does this work?
Yeah, that never, ever happens to me. I hear of writers who say that, and they say, oh, this character just wouldn't stop talking, and I originally was a 20-page story, and then it grew to a 300-page novel. To me, that's an utterly foreign concept. That has literally never happened to me. I think it's because the two novels that I have written, they just required so much work and stubbornness and insane cussedness to keep going to finish them into a novel that, you know, they could never be anything other than a novel. For me, a story, I'm always, I think, convinced of what the structure is going to be pretty early on, and I know that when I'm writing it, it starts a story and it stays a story. I've never had this amazing, you know, puppets take over from the Puppet Master experience.
So you pretty much have planned the structure and the characters from the get-go. I mean, how loose do you keep things so that there can still be an aspect of discovery, or do you just really have to think them all through in advance?
Well, I'm a planner in life, and I'm a planner in fiction as well. But with stories, I would say I often have an ending in mind, but the ending is vague. I often use the analogy. I think of it as a piece of music where I have a sense of what kind of note I want the story to end on, a major chord, a minor chord, a rousing finale, or a wistful single note, you know, hanging in the air. And then I write toward that. Or sometimes I have a last line that I really like, and I go ahead and I type that at the bottom of the Word document. For me, it's a way of reducing the crushing anxiety of the blank page or the blank screen, as the case may be. So I have something there at the end that I can write to, even if by the time I get there, I wind up changing it. For me, that reassurance is what enables me to write through all the bajillion things that I don't know.
Are you the type of writer who absolutely doesn't want to even deal with the story when it's done and you want to move on to the next thing? Or do you find something to love about the work, especially when you have to revisit it? It's even worse if you're a short story writer, because when your stories are collected, then you have to deal with stuff that you have closed shop on, like from 6, 7, 8, 10 years ago. So, you know, how do you deal with this? I mean, are these stories dead in the water? Where's the life, the passion, or is it people like me who say, hey, this is a good story that kind of keeps you going on this?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. Recently in the fall, I was doing a reading, and it was at a university, and they had read, the students there had read for a course my first book of stories. So they asked me to read from it, and I did. I read the first story from that book out loud, and I was completely horrified by it. I mean, it was so long ago, and all I could see were the flaws of it, and I had to physically restrain myself from editing it there at the podium. It seemed so kind of baggy and loose, and could be tightened up so much. So I think that, you know, it seemed almost so foreign that another person could have written it, and that says something about the passage of time. The stories in this new book, I would say, they're more recent. I mean, they're only from the past maybe 3 or 4 years, and I feel pretty fondly toward them, and I'm excited for them to be out in the world in book form, because the life of a story in a literary journal or even a website is so limited. It's such a small readership, so it's kind of exciting, and I hope it's an occasion where more people can read them. I mean, that's what I would like.
Do you feel that, you know, what's the short story like today? I mean, if fewer people are reading them, or it's harder to find them, or, you know, in many cases, if I want to find a story that isn't collected, and I have to actually physically send in for that particular issue of the Missouri Review or whatever, and I can't actually access that story immediately, or I have to actually ask the author, which I have actually done, hey, can I read your story? Because I can't find it anywhere. The author is kind of like hands tied because I can't put it on my website because there's a deal going on. You know, what is, you know, how are we dealing with this notion of, you know, keeping stories alive, keeping your work alive in a supposedly free digital age when a lot of this stuff is kind of locked up behind, you know, padlocks and so forth?
Yeah, I've definitely been excited. In the past few years, I have published more and more stories online and great places. You know, like Guernica published a story of mine this spring, and it was such a cool experience because people were reading it and responding to it right away, which I remember, you know, the first stories that I published, I was very proud to have them in those little literary magazines, but they came out and they went into libraries, and the only, you know, I sent a physical copy to my mom and she read it and said something, but the experience of having some kind kind of public. I think, you know, the digital revolution has been nothing but an enormous boon for short story writers. You know, as to the larger fate of the short story, I mean, who knows? But I do think that because the audience for them is more limited than the novel, the people who are writing them are freed from commercial constraints in a way that is probably to the good. And the people who are writing them are doing it as a labor of love. I mean, nobody is looking for, I don't know, a movie deal out of a short story, especially a literary short story, I don't think. So whatever formal experiments they're doing or whatever subjects they're exploring, there's a certain purity to it, I think, that is worthwhile.
Is there something about that instantaneous reaction you now get? I mean, now you can link to a story and it will make the rounds on Facebook or Twitter or whatnot, or be blogged about or be tumbled about or be, you know, insert your social media verbed about. You know, does this affect you as a writer? Has there been a situation where one of your stories has been completely misinterpreted, and how do you deal with that?
Yeah, I think it is true that probably I'm enthusiastic about this readership thing because I'm a little more seasoned. Like when I first started writing, if I had had people respond immediately, even positively, I think I would have been more freaked out. I mean, it is just weird for, you know, an introverted writer type person such as myself. But people say a lot of weird stuff about my writing, you know, when it gets published, and you know, I don't know. I try to move on from it. There was a short review that I read recently that had like 4 factual errors, you know, in like 150 words. But you know, that stuff just happens. I mean, honestly,
I made a factual error here by saying Uganda instead of Rwanda. So there you go.
There you go. You're part of the problem.
I'm part of the problem. I just corrected myself. It was Rwanda in my head, I assure you.
No problem. But anyway, I genuinely do feel like as writers we have to be grateful for any attention that we get, even stuff that's a little bit wrongheaded, just because, you know, people in our media saturated universe, it's so easy to ignore, you know, so thank God anyone reads anything.
Yeah. Do you think you're getting more traction from the short stories or the novel, would you say?
It's hard to tell. I mean, it's early days yet. You know, the books just came out last week. I mean, the whole idea at the publishing house was that doing them together would get both more attention for both. But I think it's too early to say which is going to get more traction.
Well, I mean, I ask because, like, for example, if I'm, you know, someone, I don't have a lot of money, and I have my choice between buying the hardcover or the paperback, I'm probably going to buy the paperback. And so, therefore, that, and also I could pass that along to my friends more efficiently. So, I mean, you know, have there been thoughts along those? I'm sure there have been thoughts along those lines between either you or your publisher. Have you considered anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that's true, that paperbacks are more passable, but I think, and this is just me and not my publisher, but my understanding of it is that people buy novels in such greater numbers than short stories that, I mean, the truly erroneous thing would have been to do it the other way, right? Stories in hardcover and then the novel in paperback. So, I'm not an expert on sort of trade or commerce issues, but I just cross my fingers that anything gets attention.
Well, I mean, but you know, short story collections right now, even among really great writers, they're being published less and less because of these unfortunate financial realities. And maybe things perhaps might improve in the future, you know, when we're out of like this kind of large slump. But you know, on the other hand, I mean, you know, they're not publishing short story collections in nearly the same amount of frequency that they once did, and they, unless you're like a huge writer, unless they do something like this where they're publishing 2 books in one. So you know, in light of your ability to collect stories in the future, you know, what are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, it's true that I never write stories with a view towards thinking about them as a collection. That's just not the way that I work. I know that some people do, or some people are working on a collection of themed stories set in a particular location, or, you know, based on recurring characters, which is probably smart. You know, I'm just not calculating in that respect. And when I write a story, it's for fun. It's because I have a particular idea. I get excited. I read something that somebody else wrote and I want to try my hand on it. So, and I think it would, in some ways, for me anyway, it would be dumb to do otherwise because, as you say, the marketplace is so non-existent. If I were writing them, you know, for their future best-selling potential, that would be a really, really dumb way to think about a book.
In order for you to do the best work you can't think about this.
Right, exactly. I mean, you know, I certainly hope in an abstract sense that whatever I write will eventually, you know, go out into the world, but I don't think it's good for writers to think in those terms. I actually think it's really insidious and bad for writers to always be thinking about publication while writing.
Well, on that note, Alex, it was a pleasure to chat with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.